Good morning, good morning, good morning, and thank you for joining me on another episode of Face to Face Talk Show. I am your host, Sharifa Hardy, and I have an amazing show for you today. On Face to Face, we ask the hard questions, we have the uncomfortable conversations, all so that we can make this world a better place. So if you are tuning into this show, please go ahead and share the show, because friends don't let friends miss out on Face to Face Talk Show. So I have a few different guests from different backgrounds today. I think you've met just about everyone on one show or another, but I want to start with our first guest, Mr. Salim, who is a constitutionalist. Good morning, Salim. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. How are you?
I'm excited. You don't seem excited.
I am. I'm very excited. I'm very excited. It's like I had a great, great, great time this week. So
wonderful. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Sully.
Well, I am a constitutionalist. I'm studying law until I get into the school. I'm doing a program where I can kind of fast track myself. I'm also a chef. I get to start my first culinary class this Sunday, which is amazing. Starting a new podcast, and you know, so things are looking up, you know.
But didn't you start the podcast on Monday?
Yes, but I had some technical difficulties. I did a whole hour's worth of show, and the microphone and the headphones were not integrated into my laptop. So,
I would like to say that I have done that before, but I have not. So It's okay. I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest, a knight, an actual knight, Mr. Sir Sanju. Good morning, Sanju. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fantastic. How are you?
I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to have you for the first time on Face to Face Talk Show. Typically, we're on the Roundtable Talk Show. We got you here, so I'm excited.
This is going to be cool. Looking forward to it.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I run a digital marketing agency. And basically we help people take over the world. So it's kind of become a bit of a life mission, you know, and just overall, you know, a big interest in community and in philanthropy and, you know, just helping people get where they need to be.
And why is the Face Talk Show? Why did you decide to make an appearance on this show?
Because last time when we were on the round table, you guys are pretty awesome together. And I thought it'd be kind of fun to jump into that and see what's going on this side.
Yes, we'll get into some great conversations. I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest, Mr. Shell Horowitz, who you have definitely seen on one of the other past shows. Good morning, Shell. How are you?
Just great, Sharifa.
Thank you for joining us. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I have had, for the last 20 years or so, I've been working on braiding together the activist side with the marketing side. So helping the world be a better place, but doing it through showing businesses how to make money doing the right thing. This is my 10th book, Guerrilla Marketing to Heal the World, co-authored with the late J. Conrad Levinson. And my website is goingbeyondsustainability.com. And on the activist side, I'm involved with a group called Jewish Activists for Immigration Justice. We went to the border last February and were horrified by what we saw. And been doing a lot of work around that. And very eager to start the new year and a new time for this country.
Yes, I am eager as well. We're going to come back to you, Shell. I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest. Emily and Courtney are joining us. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
You are so welcome.
Thank you so much for having us as well.
You are welcome. Now, Emily, you joined us on a previous show, correct?
Yes. Yeah. And I was also just kind of curious to get over here and also have Courtney come in as my we are co-hosts of a podcast and wanted to be in something together.
Wonderful. Tell us a little bit about your podcast.
Courtney, go ahead.
Our podcast, Humanized, is about social justice stories from the heart. Just trying to show the heart behind the stories and the individuals who are actually doing the work. This first season, we're starting off with ourselves and starting off just showing the stories from ourselves, our perspective, our views, which will hopefully open up the conversation to push the conversation to where it needs to be, and also to push culture and progression where it should be as well.
Where do you feel it should be?
Nah, you trying to go to, you trying to take notes from my show, man.
I'm not taking notes. We're on face-to-face talk show. We ask the hard questions. Like, we have the uncomfortable conversations.
I love it. I love it. Where do I want social justice to go? When it's equitable for all? You know, I feel as though individuals get into social justice for many times, and no judgment, and from a place of comfort, what's not going to affect them, but also want to do the work that is really hurting and killing other individuals. And you can't have it both ways. If you're going to be a warrior, you should be able to go around with the and expect the discomfort that comes along with that fight. And so if you ask me where do I want social justice to be, is pure and authentic, and getting back to exactly what it should be. And that is doing the work and not giving the illusion of work being done.
Mm-hmm. And for you, Emily, what is it for you?
Mm-hmm. I echo so much of what Courtney says, and I feel like on a cellular level, it's everybody has a right to have a calm nervous system and to walk through the day feeling confident that they can feel safe and secure, and they're navigating challenges in life just like any other person next to them. And so that's how I kind of orient, is around like the right to a calm nervous system. And so that's what I feel like justice will look like.
Mm-hmm. Salim, you're joining us. You're here. We listen to Emily. We listen to Courtney. They seem so passionate. Yet I know when you get out there with your activism, you're like, let's tear it up. Let's yes. redo everything. Talk uh-huh. to us.
Well, so I applaud everybody's movements and different things into things, but I think some of the things that we are looking at, we're not looking at inept. And what I mean by that is we're not looking at it into an in-depth quality that we can actually logically do it without looking at the confrontation, without looking at the emotions, without looking at everything that's going to come about it. So you remember, Sharifa, when I talked about the word black, and I talked about it being a non-legal status. I talked about it not being a nationality. Now, the questions that I got back from that was feedback was emotional content. And that sometimes we don't look at the emotional content that is connected to something until we want to look at it. Now, if their emotional contact connection to a riot, we'll look at that and we'll say Black Lives Matter, we'll do all that, we'll do that. But when we talk about slavery, we won't talk about the emotional connections that's with that that are still stimulating to this day. So what I mean is, are we ready to really get into the nitty gritty? Get into the actual conversation, get into the actual actions of it. I mean, what about taking down holidays, changing images of people, things like that? I really myself don't see America doing that, because I feel that we've been indoctrinated for the past 256 years. We've been occupied for about the past 500 years. Africa's been done the same exact way. We have people claiming things that's of our culture that we can't even get back or be seen as. The natural or aboriginal of anything, unless it's crime or the NBA. So when I see groups that do that, I applaud it, but I always look at it logically, because at the end of the day, I'm going to be looked at as a Black man in America.
What is it that you would like the world to do? You said take down the holidays and...
Well, the first thing, so Gil Scott-Heron said the revolution would not be televised. And what he meant by that is that the first revolution that one goes through is the one internally. So we're going to have to deal with the N-word problem, because we have a lot of our people that are tearing us down and enforce stereotypes. But we also have to deal with white fragility. We also have to deal with the blames of society that goes to the white progressive. Martin Luther King even said about that in his last book. So there's a lot of things that we have to look at naturally before we can even talk about, well, what does reparations look like? What does unity look like? What does a community look like? What does a neighborhood look like? Before we get into any of those, we have to be able to stand with truth. Because there are some people that just want to admit Donald Trump's a racist. Some people will not admit that Joe Biden is a racist, you know, or Kamala Harris, or they will not admit the true things. Obama did not do a lot for us, but they don't want to admit it because they say, oh, well, we got a first Black president, so we can't blemish this. No, we need to start telling the truth. People are dying. You know, Sandra Bland died in blackface.
You know what I'm saying? You hit so many different points, Salim. So many different directions. Sorry. I would love to. No. It's okay. It's wonderful. I love it. But I would love to have Cheryl. I saw you nodding your head. What were some of your thoughts when Salim was speaking? He's on mute. Cheryl will be fine. Cheryl, you want to unmute yourself?
Salim, first, I want to say that I've been there with you on the microphone problem. I had to re-record an interview with Swami Beyondananda years ago because it didn't take. So I do see that we have some systemic problems that we need to address, and they're big ones. You know, Biden talks about Build Back Better, and I want to make sure that better part is part of it, that we can't return to the normal of 2019 or even the pre-Trump normal of 2015. And I think we actually have an opportunity right now that because COVID changed everything, the idea that we can't change things, bye, we can. We've proven it. So if we can seize that moment and get to a world where hunger and poverty and racism are basically extinct and where climate change is being solved, and war is not how we resolve our grievances, I think if we can get enough momentum around this, that could happen. And if we don't get that momentum, we'll just go back to the same old, and if we're lucky, it'll be 2015 instead of 2019. But I did note that Obama came in after what was then the worst president in history and spent all 8 years trying to roll us back to about where we were before that started. And now we've seen that it can go much, much worse than it did under George W. Bush. And we've got a lot farther that we've got to pull back into and then beyond where we were to where we want to be.
Where's that gauge? So I'm not saying that I disagree with you, but we always saying that we're doing better or to a specific. So if we put civil rights at a 7, Obama maybe have taken it up to a 10. Are we doing better in the grand scheme of things? Because, you know, we always say that we have to do this, or, you know, hunger is an easy problem. Teach people how to eat and teach people how to stop wasting. Mm-hmm. That's really, really good. Shut down the corporations.
It's wasted.
Yeah, I mean, California itself serves 60% of all produce in the United States. So that shows you what type of food and everything we got. Those type of things that we can do. Racism is always looked at as an event that just a group of people can switch this. Racism is a system.
Yep.
It is a system. So what are we doing actually to benefit some solutions from the system? Because this whole like, oh, well, let's wait for another 4 years and let's hope and let's do that. No, George Floyd still died with hope. You see what I'm saying? These kids still go out here dying from hope. What legislation has ever changed anybody's mind?
Well, it's not necessarily a legislative solution. I believe in the power of the people. You know, governments come around when the people demand it. That's what happened in the civil rights movement. That's what happened in the feminist movement. That's what happened in LGBT. It was not the government saying, oh, here, have a little handout. We're going to make things better for you. It was people stepping up and saying, we're not going to take this anymore. We're going to do it differently. And I do think we have a moment, and I have to tell you, Biden was not my first choice among the Democrats, was not my 10th choice among the Democrats, but he's what we got to work with. And the nice thing is that he's an adversary that we can push. He will be much more receptive to the progressive message than Trump was. We've had 4 years of going absolutely in the wrong direction. And while Biden, I don't expect to be a charismatic leader carrying the torch, I think he will be able to be shaped. But we've got to have the momentum behind that so that he wants to be shaped.
So if we're going in the wrong direction with Trump, Malcolm X said we were 50 years in the wrong direction then. So what president has actually done anything for Black people? I'm not talking about for America. I'm talking about for a people that is oppressed, a people that is systemically kept down, a people that is in some ways we're looked at as willfully ignorant, but we're not looked at the programming. Like, we can talk about how we get our basketball skills or football skills from daddy and mommy, but we can't talk about how we get the self-hate from the slave master. So what are we actually doing in America for these people? Because until these people are taken care of, we're never going to get anything straight. We can't even look at slavery as what it was. We keep calling these people founding fathers, but we'll never call Thomas Jefferson a occupationist, a terrorist, or a rapist. We forget that he was a pedophile. Sally Hemings was 14 years old, and his sister, his half sister of his wife, and he's able to do the exact things. And when we talk about Donald Trump, let's mind you that he did pardon Jack Johnson, which no Democrat had did. He pardoned Susan B. Anthony. And what other president besides, I mean, not even Obama, has invited to talk to Ice Cube, has invited to talk to Black people, period. We get the whole thing when the elections come about. Oh, yeah, yeah, we're going to do things for Black. We're going to do things for Black. And then when they get the tickets, like, well, everybody counts. Well, when you talk about the feminist movement, I don't see them talking about, well, everybody, we needed to do something for everybody when the feminist movement came. When the gay rights came about, using the same civil rights that Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Medgar Evers died for, they didn't say, well, we need to do this for everybody. But when it comes to Black people, the first thing that we're told, oh, well, everybody needs to do something. No. What are we going to do for Black people? Joe Biden has been a segregationist. He voted against the very civil rights that Martin Luther King and them were talking to. When he ran again in the 80s, he was looked at as a plagiarizer. So how am I supposed to believe him now? Because he ran with a Black man? What are we going to do in society? Because people have not changed their mind. Remember, Obama was called Puff the Magic Negro. And that was in the 2000s. So I can see people haven't gotten closer together. They've gotten further apart and they've gotten lazy. And the progressivism is not really, it's an illusion. I'm sorry, it's just an illusion to me.
Well, I mean, that's why everyone is entitled to their own opinions and their own views. Emily, I would love to hear from you.
I know Courtney has something to say too. I've never heard him this quiet before in my life.
Emily always tosses the ball to Courtney. Right back to Emily. What are your thoughts?
I was just thinking, Salim, what you said a little while ago about like, we have to look at these things first. And the thing that struck me is like, we have to deal with white fragility first. That feels like we're going to be hundreds of years before we get any progress if we deal with that first. I think it has to be like this, you know, this multi-pronged system, you know, like we have Imbrex Kindy pushing the systematic like policy view. That's not the way that my mind thinks. So thank goodness there are people that I'm guessing with the work in the Constitution, that might be how your mind thinks more. And Courtney and I think more about the micro moments, like how do we create actual moments of connection between people that's honest and authentic and help, you know, for better or for worse, hold people's hands and actually facing issues honestly, because the white fragility is so strong and so big that it's something that it's like a constant picking, and you know, I deal with it all the time. And on our podcast Humanize, we just try to be really transparent about that process. So I just kind of hope that we don't need to do those things first before we see progress.
So Emily, people use a lot of different terms, a lot of different verbiage. I'm big on semantics. So when you say white fragility, what is your definition?
I see it as the product of white supremacy conditioning, where we are conditioned to deny racism, to deny slavery, to deny any of this happened. We're also simultaneously conditioned in this environment where the concept of racism has been conflated with being a bad person, which I think has halted the conversation. I think everyone is conditioned in racism and internalizes it in different ways. And so when I bring up a conversation with someone and, you know, tell a friend like, hey, we're all racist, we have to deal with this, the defense is so strong because it's, you just told me that I'm a bad person and I'm a good person. I have good intentions. And so it's navigating that intersection of ego and enculturation and, you know, perceived self-worth, so that stops the conversation. And so we need to be able to open up spaces where that conversation can be had, where it's not so threatening, which requires work on the part of white folks to just be able to be like, wait, let me let me hold that. I see that that's a product of my conditioning. That's not reality. That is something I've been taught and repeated through media, through, you know, subtle things through my education system. So that's what I, that's how I see white fragility showing up in myself and in other people too.
Mm-hmm. So I was listening to you speak and I heard what you had to say. I'm not necessarily one of those people who would agree. Actually, you know, I disagree as far as everybody is racist. I don't believe everyone is racist in any form or fashion. I believe that we all stereotype. I believe that we all may prejudge someone, but to actually be racist and have that racist hate in the heart, I don't see that across the board.
I think it's, and looking at semantics, it's how we use the terms. I think, you know, looking at really early childhood studies right now, they know that as soon as at least white kids are about two, they're starting to tune into different race structures and tuning into to hierarchies. And so I use the term racist. It's a good question. I use the term racist as we are conditioned to see people in different ways. And if we then add in power, we are then conditioned to treat people in different ways. And some people I feel like are more attuned to that. And there's such a wide spectrum, but I think it's part of, and I don't want to be so sweeping to say everyone, because I don't know everyone in the world, but like, I think it's a part of every person's reality, especially in the US where race constructs have been pushed so much. So I don't think everyone is KKK, you know, like that's, I don't work with people like that. I work with people, I live in Boulder, Colorado. People believe they're really progressive, myself included. And I think that we just have a lot more waking up to do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Sandra, you've been incredibly, incredibly, unusually quiet. Sandra.
This is kind of interesting. So I'm learning from a different side of the border, right? So I'm up in Toronto. You know, I was actually born in Africa. You know, we immigrated here, and I was one of maybe three brown kids in my whole school. Uh-huh. Right. So I've kind of, obviously not to some extent, but I've gone to that whole process of, you know, the racism side of it, the judging side of it, the, you know, the whole, whatever you want to call it, stereotypes that come with that. But, you know, in kind of listening to you guys, I really feel that systematically, a lot of this comes down to the education side of it at that young age. I find that, you know, being able to change things like, you know, the history that's being taught, that from who is actually who and what they actually did, good or bad. You know, so people, so kids or the younger generation at that point is actually understanding the difference between, yes, on one hand, you did good for the country, but on the other hand, there's all this other stuff that, you know, you shouldn't be really respecting or celebrating, and being able to differentiate those two things. The other part that I want to comment on is, you know, as much as we want to get the people involved, let's say, or create those movements, it's how do you prevent, and, you know, it's just kind of a question, but how do you prevent people from just becoming followers in the sense of not actually understanding or believing in what they're following, but just going along because it seems to be the cool thing to do, right? And that I think we saw over the summer where a lot of people joined different movements, but unfortunately, not in the ideal way, right? And caused a lot more harm than they did good to the actual message I was supposed to be conveyed, right? So these are kind of things that are going through my head. You know, I love the group today. It's so cool because I'm actually learning a lot of things, or understanding a lot of things that, you know, systematically in the back of my head I'm aware of, but you don't consciously bring it to the forefront to think about.
Mm-hmm. Or to actually have that conversation or actually verbalize some of those thoughts. So it was certain things that you mentioned that I want to come back to. But before I do that, I would love to allow Courtney an opportunity to hear his thoughts on the conversation thus far. You're on mute, Courtney. I muted you.
First, I appreciate it. You spoke of semantics. And when I think of racism versus prejudice, that's the semantics that I think about. You know, I don't think an individual or individuals can be racist. I think systems are racist. Individuals are prejudiced. And so when you think about systems, i.e. healthcare, education, mass incarceration, housing, government politics, all of those systems have been racist in order to give privilege to one group of people. You know, and so the US, the system is doing exactly what it was set up to do, to protect and serve individuals that it was created to protect and serve. And so instead of individuals trying to reform or reshape that system, it has to be, it has to be broken down and dismantled 100%. Because now as we live, individuals that are people of color and are indigenous will never truly be able to benefit from that system. That's like you trying to put diesel in a car that can only take gasoline. You know, you're going to mess up the whole engine. You have to create a new car. You know, you have to build a new engine. And so a lot of times when people use the word racist and prejudice synonymously, right there, it's incorrect. You know, it's just an easier way to say something. However, the system is very racist. The system doesn't allow for people of color to advance in a way that they should, given the equity that has been placed into America. And so at the end of the day, if we're having a conversation honestly about what's prejudice and what's race, we have to unpack those words from the beginning. It can be a synonymous and a thing of just, oh, you're playing semantics. No, those are both two different words and you're not addressing an issue. And when people say, like, I love it when people say Barack Obama didn't do anything for Black people and Trump did more for people of color. Both of those systems were in place to do exactly what they're supposed to do, right? So no matter what Barack Obama wanted to do, the racist system of politics wouldn't allow him because he's just a president. The individuals that have the true power is the House and the Senate, you know? And both of them at that time were majority white and Republican. And so anything that was coming to them they were gonna shut it down anyway. So, and now on the other side, Trump did a lot of things to gain the votes of people of color. So he was playing a game. He gave HBCUs a lot of money and also took away DEI training in those schools. So yeah, you can get all my money, but I don't want you to talk about the realities of slavery. I don't want you to talk about, because I don't want you to tarnish the image of this system that I have profited from for so much time. And so at the end of the day, both men have to play a game. So both systems have to be dismantled, because when we say Barack didn't do nothing for Black people, we're giving him too much power, you know? We're not putting the blame as where it should be. The system of politics is one that's gonna only, until it's dismantled, until we get to the progressive situation, because men change. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden is he's not my person anyway. Kamala Harris, there's a lot of men in California that are still messed up behind the actions of Kamala Harris, you know? And so at the end of the day, politics is a game that is to be played. And if you really want to address inequities and inequalities, you have to understand the system and be willing to dismantle it by any means necessary. You know, so
by any means necessary. I hear you, Courtney Salim. I know you was just itching to come on, Salim. That's your speech right there.
I'm sorry. No, I agree. I agree definitely with the brother, but you know, this is why I said we gotta think about things and talk about them logically. So if we dismantle any system, our people are still going to suffer, because what do our people produce? Nothing. I mean, I had to tell one of the young guys that was, you know, trying to sell me weed in front of a McDonald's, brother, you don't even grow the own weed you smoke. You don't. We don't produce nothing but hot air, you know. So, you know, when I say like a Democrat or a Republican is not doing anything, I'm never on the side of either. I'm never on the side of the government, you know. But when we say words like that, white people get fearful. And it's things that we need to talk about. I mean, I got a lot of European descendant friends, and I still say the same exact things. The vast majority of white people are scared that we are going to do to them what their ancestors have done to us, all right? So we clearly need to talk about that. Now, some of them do need to be wrapped up and thrown in the ground, like David Duke and all them ones like that. But it's a lot of things that need to be wrapped up and thrown away that we do. And I'm still talking about that. No matter what we do in a revolution, what are we doing as a people? Chinese people don't worry about Democrats or Republicans because their communities are still done with their communities. Jewish, they don't care about whoever is president. because their communities are still going to run well. They got their own schools. They got their own anything. We don't have nothing. And nobody has produced more than we have in the United States. Native Americans didn't go through slavery and make cotton, tobacco, and all these things, worldwide things. When we talk about contributions to America and being left out, we need to tackle everybody because we have no allies. Even in the Hispanic and Latino community, they call you Afro something if you look too Black. So we need to really relegate and discuss the problems. Why all this consciousness and we don't bank Black? You know what I'm saying? It's out there. Why are we always looking for someone to fix something? Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey would have never did that. So when I'm talking about the conversation, I'm not negating it for action. I'm just saying that there are some things that we really need to sit back and think about that we're just still really just overlooking. But no, brother, I agree exactly with what you're saying. Because, I mean, the systemic jail problem, the healthcare problems that none of us talk about, the fact that the culinary industry, the food industry, all these type of industries have been racist towards us, man. So, I mean, but we have to get ourselves together as a collective because we're the only people that's always put into a box and Black people got to be this type of way. And, you know, sometimes that's our own detriment.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think you were responding, Courtney, but you're muted. So I wasn't able to hear you.
Oh no. I appreciate it. Yes. My Celine, man. 100% true. You're right on point. And at the end of the day, we have to realize like where I come from is nothing, you know, it's poverty, you know? And so poverty is another creation, another system that benefits someone else. Capitalism. If capitalism was pure in its purest form as an entrepreneur, as a businessman, I love capitalism. However, I'm trying to change what capitalism looks like because in order for it to exist how it exists today, poverty has to coexist because someone has to be rich and someone has to be poor in the system that is we playing in the game we playing today. Men of color have been engineered to think that in order for me to succeed, I have to kick down someone that looks like me. Whether they want to admit it or not, white is right. You know, so if I'm selling some pencils right next to a white man selling some pencils, his pencils must be sharper, better, gonna last longer than my pencils. They could be the exact same thing. You know, and yeah, and so I agree. Like we have some reverse engineering that we have to do if we ever really want to escape poverty, escape slavery, because we're still in slavery now. It may be even worse because it's more mental. You know, but at least back then, when slavery was existing, we saw the chains. We knew who the clear person was, and even in that system, you got 400, 500 people on a plantation, one slave master house. How were they not able to take over the slave? Because they had their mind. Because the mind, it's a mind game. And once you do certain things and you play a certain system and you show you do this, I'm going to take this away from you. And as we move further on in history, and even people of color who have been able to become millionaires and billionaires, they're very scared to help their own communities for a myriad of reasons. You know, like why if there are so many millionaires, especially millionaires of color, why is poverty still raging in mainly communities of color? It's because we would rather play the game and look good and give our money overseas instead of domestic work. And I like this is why as I work in entrepreneurship and as I was in the hospital as a doctor, I quickly saw that this system is not for me. Because I felt hypocritical. I felt like my people are out there dying. I'm in here setting up a life. I have to use the information that I have to save a culture. Because I'm not saying other people can do it, but not too many people are doing it. And if I represent a move, because the days of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, those days are over. You know, so we have to galvanize the people to come together in a really intelligent way. To really start to move culture as far as housing and economics and healthcare and politics, because we feel as though at least we can get this. We yes. don't. Why do I need that? At least I have a job where I can go to every day. That's not good enough, man. At least like we're brilliant. We're so willing to give away our brilliance at a cost. when individuals who are our counterparts understand entrepreneurship, raise their kids not to be employees, raise their kids to be employers. Like, yes, this is, I need you. So I'm sorry. I'm passionate about this. Oh,
yeah. No, I can tell that everyone, that's what we do. We get passionate here on Face to Face Talk Show. I just want to go back to Emily real quick, because we had this discussion. We're talking about white fragility, and then we kind of turned the conversation into, you know, everyone is racist. You know, there's systematic racism, prejudice. What are your thoughts as we continue the conversation, Emily?
You know, I was wondering if, so I tend to fall into this place, especially with white people, of like trying to kind of poke them to get at the truth of who they are. And that may be actually why I'm a little bit more inclined to call people racist, because I'm principally surrounded by white people. And I think that there's like a benefit for people to be conditioned to like have direct things like, let's talk directly about this. Let's deal with your trigger right now so that potentially in another situation, you have more grace in dealing with it. So I may be using that term a little bit more loosely because of what I'm able to do with those conversations when really direct language is used. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate hearing, you know, maybe a little bit more thought into the exact semantics. And I know Courtney and I have talked about racist versus prejudice before.
But it's kind of what Courtney was saying. I think that that's the main example, is that racism has to do with power. The power I have over you, the ability to lord something over you, and the ability to take something away from you, i.e. your freedom. Yes. So never in the history of time has any other people, as far as our people, been able to say, you know what, Emily, if you don't do what I like, or if you're not doing this, I can take away your freedom. I can take away your life. So to say that everyone has that same ability to
Absolutely. There has to be this like this lens of power in it. I guess I'm also like exploring how, you know, people of color internalize, you know, like internalize anti-Blackness and internalize, you know, like these different things. And I don't know what that's called when it's internalized, Yeah, I don't know exactly what the term for that is.
I don't either, because you just gave me a new term, anti-Blackness. I've never even heard that term, honestly, in 44 years. I just heard racist. Oh, wow. Like, if you're anti-Black, you're just racist. You know, so
In Layla Saad's White Supremacy and Me, she talks quite a bit about anti-Blackness and encouraging people to explore how are they conditioned into anti-Blackness and, just to acknowledge, not my term.
I have to check that out, because to me it sounds like one of those terms. I see you, Shell. I'm gonna get to you, but it just seems like what I've seen in my experience is we create terms to minimize an effect, right? So when you don't want to say a person is racist, you say they're anti-Black, okay? But it's still racist if you're against anybody because you feel that you are above or superior to them. We can sugarcoat it, we can, you know, play all these different games, but at the end of the day, to me, in my humble opinion, it is what it is. Shell, you had some thoughts?
Yeah, I want to respond both to Courtney and to you, Sharifa. First to Courtney, I don't think business has to be zero sum. I think we need to be looking at creating models of business where a whole lot of different people win. It's not just whoever happens to be sitting in the CEO chair or the stockholders. And I think we know how to do that. We've been very poor about implementing it, but we actually know how these things work. One example that I love is there's a company called DLight, that's lowercase d period L-I-G-H-T, and they sell solar-powered LED lamps to replace kerosene. Kerosene is toxic, it's flammable, you have to buy kerosene every month, it's fossil fuel-based, a lot of problems with that. And then instead of that, they sell these on a time payment so that if you're living in some very poor community in a developing country and you're spending $2 a month on kerosene, so maybe for the first 10 months, you spend that same $2 a month instead to pay off your lamp, and then you have it free and clear, becomes a ladder out of poverty. I don't want to go into the specifics of how right now, because that'll take too long. So that's one thing. And then the other, to Sharifa, the question of anti-Black versus racism. I think that it, I'm trying to remember who it was that started to, I think it might've been Emily who talked about societal racism as opposed to individual racism. I think the only way we're gonna be able to talk to people who don't see themselves as racist but are enabling racism in various ways is to say, no, we're not saying that you are racist, but you are participating in a racist system, you're benefiting from it. And we can help you figure out some ways around that. And then the other thing that Courtney said that always makes me stop and say, whoa, is the phrase by any means necessary. And yeah, I'm aware of some of the history of that with Malcolm and whatnot, but to me as a nonviolent activist, I always want to look for the solution that engages the people, that doesn't create barriers, that is actually more effective. Even during the Nazi years in Germany and Eastern Europe, the most of the successful resistance was nonviolent, and that was not a coincidence.
That was a pause.
It is. Yeah, no, I
the edge of my feet. Go ahead, Courtney.
When I said it by any means necessary, I'm also pretty sure that, and who knows what Malcolm was talking about, but you have to think about it as a means of protection. You know, if someone kicks in your door and comes into your house, a conversation is not be had. You're going to protect your wife and children by any means necessary. It always, it kind of laughable to me when individuals say by any means necessary, we go straight to violence. That's not what I mean. By any means necessary means that instead of buying rims for your car, you put rims and you put the money into an investment for a business. That's by any means necessary for me. You know, instead of going to waste time over here, you work on a craft that's going to uplift your community. That's by any means necessary. You do whatever it takes to receive an education. You know, and that to me is by any means necessary. It's not, I wasn't speaking from a place of let me go and the first white person that says something to me, let me slap them. You know, like, that's not by any means necessary. That's just reciprocity with ignorance. You know, like if you're ignorant. However, if I felt my life is in danger, I will protect my life and the life of those I love by any means necessary up on and onto violence. That's what I meant. That's what I meant. You know, so it's not, I don't think he meant by any means necessary, let's go over there and assassinate the president because he's racist. Nah, that's not by any means necessary. That's just you in giving an in-kind donation back to a person. Like I'm giving you back what you gave me. That's not the way to work, you know? And so it's really cerebral with the by any means necessary from where I'm coming from with it.
I hear you, Courtney, but I want to go in a completely different direction with some of the things that you said, because I heard you mention this a couple of different times as far as the things that we buy and the things that we purchase. And you mentioned the rims. And this is one of my favorite conversations of all times. I love having this conversation because I hear so many people, and typically those people are Black people, who say, okay, well, you know, the amount of wealth that we have in our community, and we buy Jordans and we buy rims and we buy all these different things and we buy the iPhone. And so that's the issue. So my response to that is always this: it's not that we're the only community that does those things and buys those things. To me, what I see as the major problem more than anything else is that we do not have discretionary income to be able to buy the things that we want to buy. So when someone else in a different community goes out and buys, you know, I love looking at some of the Saudi princes and the you know, Brunei, like all of these people, when they're not just buying rims, their whole entire car is gold plated. Nobody says anything, but they have the income to be able to do whatever they want. Does that make sense? I saw Shell over there nodding. So I at least know Shell was on the same page.
You make sense. But that just, Sharifa, you just expounded on something that our people do, and you just solved something, and I hope people got it. We can't floss to anybody else. See, Arabs, they can floss. They got Arab money. that oil can gold plate anything. You know what I'm saying? Like they got that, but we can't do that. Like you said, we don't have that discretionary income. We don't produce, we don't do anything like that. You know? So no, you right on.
To me, that's the root of the issue, though. That's the root of the problem, is that we don't have the income to be able to just simply do whatever we want to do. There are people, you know, you talk about Jordans, you talk about rims. There are people who one fork costs more than some people make an entire, you know, 2 or 3 years, you know?
That's the master complex.
Yes, I agree 100%.
We're never, you know what I'm saying? Like, we're never going to say anything against master. Subconsciously, we're not. Like, I mean, like,
can you say more about the master complex?
So the master complex is like this. So I understood what Shell was talking about when talking about nonviolence, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that's a general term to somebody who is looking at things or trying to do reactionary or violent, right? Now, that's what the master would say to the slave. No, don't hit back. Don't do that. You better not. Because if somebody that you look at is superior to you, that you better not do that. Now, if some brothers around the block beat up your sister, look at you real weird or whatever like that, you go back to your same elders, you better get that nigga. What, you gonna let him disrespect you like that? See, we'll turn on each other. We'll show off in front of each other. We'll do all that. We'll hit flashpoints, but we will never do that to master. Never. So when somebody like me that comes out, when I say by any means necessary, I mean just that. Because you're not going to tell me to be nonviolent when somebody's beating my ass. I'm sorry. I'm not going to do that. I am going to be the one that's going to turn up and I'm going to flash on you. But I'm also going to tell my people, hey, you're asleep. You're doing this wrong. As soon as this person, like when the white gangs were going east of Hawthorne, or west of Hawthorne into the black neighborhoods, they could do that. But when the black and Latino gangs were going east of Hawthorne into their neighborhoods, they were getting locked up. See, we can't do that with master, because racism is still comfortable. Like, we'll talk about, we'll make jokes about Jesus all day and everything like that, yet he's still a white dude with brown hair, blue eyes, and everybody gonna talk about the truth of Jesus. We will never go against master, never. Deep down to the subconscious.
Did that answer your question, Emily? Did I make it clearer for you?
I love just like a straight up definition of the term. Those were good examples, but I would, just to make sure I have it clear.
The term of what, going against master?
Is it like a master complex? Like I saw a couple people.
Call it a condition uh-huh. or a systematic issue from programming. Uh-huh. We are programmed not to go against white people. You got to think, in Jim Crow times, it was illegal for black people to look a white person in the eye, to not move off the sidewalk from them. It was capital punishments to learn how to read.
Yeah.
All the sharecropping, all the things that we did. So we're not going to go against master, period. And that just shows the programming that we have been in America, in the world, basically. Because as smart as Egypt was, as smart as Ghana and all them were, none of them are ever looked up as smart as Rome or Greek. Mm. The middle of the common world is France and things like that. So we'll never go against master.
Mm-hmm. So Salim, I just want you to clarify, because I think this might be, you know, part of what's being missed, is that when you say master, many people would think, okay, well, that was slavery. That was over. That was done. How is that applicable? Because I think that's part of the question. How is that applicable to 2020 or even, you know, 2021?
Okay. Well, man, that's a very good question. But it just shows exponentially how slavery was mental. So you have a superior, inferior effect. And there are still people today that will not buck the system, no matter what is going on. When I converted to Islam, when I started finding truth, there were some guys that they just can't give up for it. They can't give up the Gregorian holidays. They just can't give that up. And it pains people. But you see in today where it's racist, but the privileged class can say, well, I don't see racism. So it's still that time to where you can just defer responsibility. You can defer things still. Slavery, that went on, but we're still under a mental handcuff. You know, a lot of people still say, we got to do this, we got to do this, and we need to gain momentum. It's 256 years of people getting oppressed, killed, lynched, beating, shot in front of you, choked out. If that is not convincing enough, then you're not going to move. And that's that same mentality. when reparations mm-hmm. are talked up, we think about wealth, but then we instantly want to deem it to education, where mm-hmm. if I have a bachelor's degree and this person dropped out of school, they make more than I do. Like, nah, we need to stop doing the indoctrination, because it's going to keep up that same thing of not going against master.
That was very interesting. Very interesting. Someone was about to say something.
I was, yeah. Salim, I think we need to make a distinction between nonviolence and non-conflict. I'm a believer in conflict. I'm a believer in pressing the power structure. I'm a believer in the power of the people to make change. But tactically, morally, and in a whole lot of other ways, nonviolent conflict, nonviolent pressure works a whole lot better. You know, we saw it in, for example, the night that the Germans were going to round up the Jews in Denmark, the Danes boat lifted them all to Sweden. I mean, the entire community got moved overnight secretly. That was incredible. You know, in my tradition, there's a story that, as far as I know, is the oldest recorded incident of nonviolent resistance, and that was the midwives Shifra and Pua, who refused to kill the Hebrew babies under Pharaoh's orders and said, sorry, we can't get there in time. Those Hebrew women, you know, they just have their babies for war, can't even get there, and then it's too late. And everybody knew that they were lying, and that the real reason is that they didn't want to kill their own community's babies. And it left the Pharaoh somewhat powerless. Those babies lived, one of them grew up to be Moses, raised in the Pharaoh's own house, and led the nonviolent revolution there. You look at Tiananmen Square, look at the Arab Spring, all over the world, you see examples of people getting together, not using violence, but definitely using conflict. I've been part of some of those movements myself. I'm very proud of having been a part of the movement that basically ended nuclear power in this country when Nixon said he was going to have 1,000 plants built. And, you know, there's a lot more work to be done, but it's, to me, the you get more lasting change, you get more support from the community out there, more effective change, and fewer of you end up dead.
I like few of us end up dead. But, you know, sometimes things happen. We are coming down to the last few minutes of the show. And what I love to do at the end of every show is just simply allow my guests the opportunity to speak directly to the audience, to everyone who is watching the show live, as well as everyone who is watching in the archives, and let them know what you want them to take away from your appearance here today. And we're going to start with you, Sir Sanju.
Sure. You know, I learned a lot today. So thank you all very much. You know, there's a lot of things that you realize or you don't realize you don't know or aren't exposed to. And I got a great opportunity to get some education on it. So thank you all very much for that. I appreciate it.
You are very welcome. That's what we're here to do, to have the conversations that will start change. Emily, what do you have for us?
I feel like my reflections from today are Courtney and I have been involved recording our podcast, and it's always just him and I in the first season. The second season, which will be released next year, we're going to start bringing in people. And it's just really great to have, like, the education process is so ongoing, and I love hearing the different perspectives and being able to slow down enough to be like, yeah, the way that I'm doing things, it's got to be constantly adjusting. And so I'm grateful for the opportunity to have more adjustments and think about things in a new way. And then, yeah, to self-promote too, come find us. you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at the Humanize podcast, as well as on all the major podcast downloading services.
Absolutely. Might have to come have a seat, talk to you, sit down, chop it up, give you some more of my views, because I guarantee love it. You. Yes, they are not like everyone else's. Courtney.
Would love it.
Courtney, you back on mute.
Man, the computer telling me to shut up.
no one can tell you shut up.
No, seriously, I really appreciate the venue. I really appreciate the time. Thank you so much, Ms. Sharifa, for this opportunity. It was an honor to meet all of the guests here. Me and Emily are working really hard. So to find other individuals that are working towards this and raising awareness is such an honor and a blessing. What I could leave is just, this is the beginning of work that's going to take a lifetime. And I'm proud to be a warrior with each and every one of you. With the different perspectives, with the different outlooks on life, there's a place for all of us, and I love it. So thank you guys so much. And please, Emily gave Humanized Podcast the plug and the shout out, and I'm doing the same. You can find us on all streaming platforms, The Humanized Podcast. Much love.
Yeah. Much love to you, Courtney. Thank you for joining us today. Cheryl, what do you have for us?
Well, it was a great conversation. I really enjoyed participating. I want to leave people with the idea that any one of us can be an agent of change. Any one of us can make a difference. Doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter how humble your occupation. Rosa Parks was a seamstress, after all. Lech Walesa, later president of Poland, was an electrician working at a shipyard. But that you get that power when you work together with others, when you create movements, it's much more effective than doing it one-on-one. You can do it one-on-one, that's important too. But if you really want to shift society, you find other people who share that dream and you make it happen.
Yes, and that's what we're doing here. You have something else going on, Cheryl. Your book, and are you still doing a podcast?
I did a radio show, Terrestrial Wave, but it ended back in 2009. And I've been a guest on a lot of other people's podcasts. And I'm working right now on trying to find a market for an article called Leveraging the Great Pivot, all about how we have this opportunity I talked about at the beginning to create massive social change right now. That's a pretty rare window.
Yes, we'll have to check out that article. Please share it when it goes out. I appreciate you being here. Definitely want to invite you all to return, to come back, because this has been an enjoyable conversation. Salim, you're here with us every week. You've been here with us for months now. So I definitely appreciate you. What do you think of today's conversation?
Oh, I love it. I mean, we need more of this. You know, just the cohesiveness. There's no anger. There's nobody feeling like I need to. Well, I'm not trying to speak for everybody. I don't feel like attacked. I don't feel like, you know, I had to prove something. I just felt like I had a very healthy conversation. It was just good for the soul.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And when you have these conversations, you walk away and you think about some of the other perspectives and some of the other points. I know Emily gave me some terms that I'm going to start Googling and researching and taking apart. So I definitely appreciate you being here with us every week, Salim. But also, I want to thank all of you for being a guest on today's episode of Face to Face Talk Show, and everyone who tuned in to watch this show live, as well as everyone who is watching it in the archives. But please don't just watch the show. Don't just share the show. We appreciate that. But please be a guest on Face to Face Talk Show. Sit down with us, share your views, join the conversation. Change starts with the conversation. And that's what we do here on Face to Face Talk Show. So if you're interested in being a guest, please visit my website at ashsharifa.com. Until next Wednesday, 10 a.m. Pacific, everyone have a safe, blessed, and a happy holidays. Bye now.